From KCRW, I'm Michael Schneider, executive editor of IndieWire, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You know, I am really at the beginning of a large learning curve that others have been working on their whole lives. I spent 30 years working in front of an audience, so I got a lot of catching up to do.
Television writer-producer Chuck Lorre created some of the most successful sitcoms ever, including Two and a Half Men and The Big Bang Theory. This fall, he's got yet another show on the CBS lineup called Young Sheldon. But this time, he's working with a single camera and no live audience, which for Lorre is outside his comfort zone. He tells us why he wanted to try something different with the Big Bang Theory prequel, Young Sheldon. And he talks about another new show, the Kathy Bates pot comedy, Disjointed. That show had him turning to Netflix after the broadcast networks caught a whiff of the scripts about weed and said, pass. But first on the news banter, it's been a bummer of a summer at the box office. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, we're ending the summer with another depressing box office story, one of the worst box offices in the last two decades. And Labor Day weekend's not going to be any better because for the first time in 25 years, there's not even a big new release. What's going on?
Yeah, Hollywood is sort of packing up its wagons and going home after a summer that is somewhat depressing for the industry, at least domestically. It's looking like revenue for the summer will be down about 15%, $3.8 billion if the estimates hold. That's just domestic. International for the year to date is about 1% up, but that's still not great considering international is going to be the, you know, the big growth area for the industry. It's just been a summer of blahs, kind of. There's hasn't been those breakout billion-dollar hits that the industry has become accustomed to over the past year. And the question going around Hollywood is why?
Yeah, and the few bright spots include Wonder Woman. And of course, last summer in August, Suicide Squad definitely pumped up the box office compared to this year. So franchise mania seems to still be the answer for the studios. And that's probably why we were seeing not one, but two competing Joker projects now being discussed. A lot of Joker going on in the DC and Batman universe right now. What gives there?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a confluence of events this week. There are two Joker movies in development at Warner Brothers. One is going to be part of the extended DC universe, as they call it, with Jared Leto playing the Joker and Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn in a romance movie about just them. And then there's a separate Joker origin movie that is in development outside of the DC universe. And what these projects basically say to me is that these studios are caught in a, I call it an addiction, because when you talk to them, the executives all worry about franchise fatigue and are we going too hard on these franchise movies, you know, pumping them out, whether the audience wants them or not. Whereas, you know, you end up with something like Transformers 5, which really underperformed the previous Transformers movies, and things that really don't necessarily justify another movie, the studios are just doing it. And yet, when you see what they actually do, those concerns go out the window because every studio is now doubling and tripling and quadrupling down on their existing proven franchises.
And of course, you're seeing that on the television side as well. And the same debate that's going on in film is starting to take place in TV, which is how many Marvel shows, how many DC shows can this industry handle? And a lot of these characters now are even sort of cross-platform. So you have a Joker on the Gotham show on Fox. You've got the Flash on the CW, but you've got a Flash movie coming up. So there's also a little bit of brand confusion and universe confusion on that tip as well. And have we reached saturation point?
Yeah, I mean, Steven Spielberg and George Lucas on a panel a couple of years ago put out an alarm and said the trajectory the industry is on is not sustainable. It's going to turn into a battle amongst the superhero Star Wars franchise films, and it's going to cannibalize one another. And I think what you're seeing happen is the audience is getting tired of this stuff. And you've got to really execute, do something different within the franchise parameter and make it feel what one producer told us. The goal these days is the same but different. And I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but it really does describe what studios want right now. They want more of the same, but they want it to feel just different enough where the audience feels like they need to go to the theater and see it.
Well, the other issue too is, you know, a lot of these franchises still go blockbuster overseas. So internationally, the numbers are still just fine, right, Matt? I mean, this is another great year for box office if you look internationally, but this whole trend is really dinging domestic.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You don't get fired when you greenlight Transformers 5. You just don't, because the last one made $300 million in China. And this one probably won't make that much, but it's not going to lose money likely. And you do get fired if you put a big bet on something that doesn't work and is an original film. So that's just the nature of the world we live in. And until studios really see a downside to extending these franchises and greenlighting them, you know, without sometimes even a script in place, then we're going to continue to see more of the same.
Well, Matt, another hot topic this summer has been the cost of talent on the television side, especially as streaming services like Netflix continue to open their pocketbooks up and lure away broadcast stars and creative talent like Shonda Rhimes, for example. Now, one piece of talent who hasn't gone the streaming route yet and who's still doing quite well on the broadcast side is, of course, Judge Judy, who famously makes $47 million a year sitting behind that bench and rendering her verdicts every single day on television. But a recent deposition actually unveiled a little bit of the inside inner workings of how A-list talent negotiates with networks. And Judge Judy in particular has an interesting strategy. And when she's ready to renegotiate her deal with CBS boss Les Moonves, and you guys wrote about that at The Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah, I mean, the highest paid woman on television is still Judge Judy. And you wonder, you know, what kind of a negotiation she does with CBS. It's very simple, she says. She says she goes to the Grill on the Alley, which is a prominent restaurant in Beverly Hills. And this is every 3 years. She sits across from what she said was the president of CBS, I assume Les Moonves, because he's a talent-oriented guy. And this is the most important talent to CBS. And she says, you know what? Let's enjoy our lunch. I'm going to put my number in an envelope. I'm going to slide it across and you call me tomorrow and we'll talk, because this is not a negotiation. If you don't want to pay me, I'll go produce the show myself elsewhere. And that is the position that talent of her caliber is in these days, because if you have something that everyone wants, you are going to be able to extract a number that is extraordinary.
And this is how much leverage Judge Judy has. In one of her negotiations a couple years ago, she managed to grab the ownership for all of her shows. She recently sold that library back to CBS for $200 million, a cool additional $200 million to that $47 million she makes a year. It ain't bad to be Judge Judy.
No, it's not. But you know what? She delivers. If you look at the ratings and syndication, she is doubling, tripling, quadrupling her rivals in that spot.
And syndication still makes a difference when it comes to local TV news and also prime time. And for CBS, that's still a big business and something they still benefit from. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, the editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
I'm Ruth Whitefeather Feldman. Cannabis lawyer, cannabis activist, and just before I open the door, cannabis user. I've devoted my entire life to spreading the gospel of marijuana, the miraculous plant that has the power to heal the sick, calm the afflicted, and usher in a golden age of people not being such dicks all the time.
That's Kathy Bates in the opening moments of the new Netflix comedy Disjointed, which is available now. Bates plays the namesake of Ruth's Alternative Caring, a dispensary she owns and runs with her son Travis, played by Aaron Moten. He's a recent MBA grad and encourages Ruth and the store's other bud tenders to make a YouTube marketing video. Travis sees franchise opportunities for the operation, but Ruth isn't so sure.
Mom, this is a blueprint for the future. Recreational is now legal in California. The gold rush is on, and pretty soon, somebody's going to become the Walmart of cannabis. Why not us?
Walmart is evil.
You shop there.
Only when I'm buying in bulk. It's bulk evil.
Disjointed was co-created by our guest today, Chuck Lorre, the super producer behind some of the most successful sitcoms of the past 25 years, including Grace Under Fire, Sybil, Dharma and Greg, and Two and a Half Men. Two of his shows are still on the air today, The Big Bang Theory and Mom, both on CBS. Now, at age 64, Lorre is branching out. After decades working in broadcast, Disjointed is his first foray into the world of streaming. When I sat down with Lori in his office recently on the Warner Brothers lot, I asked him how he found himself working on a pot comedy in the first place.
This began with a conversation with David Javerbaum, who I was a big fan of. He's a writer on The Daily Show. And he wrote a one-man show for Jim Parsons that was on Broadway, which was ridiculously funny and successful. And so I was a fan of his, and we met, about 2 years ago. And he discussed the idea of doing a sitcom in a pot dispensary, and that evolved into something we wound up doing together. And we initially wrote a script that was aimed at the networks. We were thinking that, rather naively, that we were going to do
a show. That you could do a pot show on CBS. For a broadcast network, yeah.
Yeah, and we sent the script out, and it came back with a toe tag on it. It was DOA. And then we sent it to Netflix, and they were thrilled. They were really excited about it, and they greenlit it. And then the dream came true, too, that Kathy Bates agreed to do it. And then we realized, we're not on CBS. We're on Netflix. And we went back to Netflix and said, thank you for your confidence and support, but we want to throw our script out and start over.
Because it was still a little too broadcast?
It was a CBS sitcom. Yeah. It was built around, the structure that I've come to know for many, many years. And yes, it was tame, and it didn't take advantage of anything that is available in the Netflix world.
It's interesting that you went to them, that they didn't give you a note, because that's famously what Netflix is known for, is not really giving you notes, sort of letting you do what you want to do.
They gave us the freedom to figure out on our own that we had a great opportunity and we hadn't exploited it. We hadn't written for this environment, which allows you to begin with, instead of 21 and a half minutes to tell your story, you have whatever you need,
yeah.
28, 29, 31, doesn't matter. The minutes aren't really critical. And obviously you have no censorship issues or broadcast standards things. And then you have an ongoing story because the audience is watching 10 episodes. Those episodes can just flow into one
right.
another. They don't have to stand alone. In network television, the episodes really have to stand alone. And you can't assume the people that are watching saw the show last week. There's too much turnover.
Right. Well, and so in this case, you had the opportunity to do some different things. How hard was that to kind of take the shackles off?
Oh, it was wonderfully fun. It wasn't, I don't know about it being difficult as much as it being a great deal of fun. And one of the great benefits of working with David is he, unlike myself, is not shackled with 30 years of network rules. He was brand new to this. So he couldn't help but break the rules left and right. And he was proposing things right out of the gate, which were astonishingly fresh. And I just went, yes, let's do that. There was pushback. You're going to do animation every episode. That's ridiculous. It's expensive. It's this and that. I just went, let's do it.
Yeah.
And I believe he proposed that we build commercials into the show. And I was like, this is great. We can deconstruct a sitcom.
I was going to say, I was wondering if you missed commercials too much. It's like, let's still have a commercial break.
Let's make our own commercials. It was, what a great opportunity. We can make our own commercials, about the cannabis industry as if it were legitimate, as if it was Budweiser. And he came into this with the ability to easily deconstruct the genre, which is, I thought, something worth doing.
Well, it's still a multi-camera sitcom, mm-hmm. so you're still doing this in front of a studio audience.
Yeah.
Did you find that the audience was a little surprised at first? They kind of expect one thing, and when Kathy Bates opens her mouth and says the F-bomb, you don't expect to see that on a multi-camera sitcom.
Yeah, the live shoots, the audience evenings turn out to be parties. When you're doing a show for Netflix, in this case, we shot 20 episodes of Disjointed, and each episode, that audience had never seen the show. They didn't know anything about it. They hadn't seen it on Netflix or anywhere else. So every episode, the audience was brand new to the show. So the learning curve was steep, but their response was terrific. And there's sort of a manic, off-the-hook quality to this that just seemed to appeal to people who, just coming in fresh every week. We have no idea who these characters are. The audience had no idea who they were. They didn't know their relationships. They didn't know if it was show 7 or show 3 or show 17. And yet it somehow worked. It was astonishing.
Yeah, well, and they also see Kathy Bates.
Well, Kathy Bates is what holds the tent up. We built the show around her. And when we approached her about this, it was the wish list, Kathy Bates at the center of this show. And she read the initial draft the draft that we hoped would be a network show. Mm-hmm. And she said yes. And then we also had to call her and say, you know that draft you read that you said yes to? We'd like to throw it out and start over. And so she was very patient with us.
And now, though, you're going to get to cuss as well on TV, Kathy.
There is that freedom. You know, that freedom comes with a price, but it was fun. Yeah. After 30 years of network television, it was greatly fun to have a character say exactly what you want them to say.
You said it comes with a price. What do you mean by that?
It can be abused. You know what I mean? It's a weapon. And it could be used to ill effect.
Was there much debate in how often are we going to use curse words and when does it work and when are we maybe overusing them?
It's just a judgment call. Yeah. I mean, it's really guesswork as to when it's appropriate and when is it lazy. But one of the great things about working with David on this was David very much wanted to do this as a four-camera audience show, despite the fact that there's a retro nature to that. It is, you know, not what's happening now, putting in a four-camera show in front of an audience and the what's called the laugh track, which I have been for decades now saying it's actually human beings.
You hate that. People use that term.
I know. Yeah. All right. I cannot fight that preconception. It seems to be embedded. But David wanted to do the four-camera audience show in order to deconstruct it, in order to turn it upside down and shake it up, which I thought was... Yes, yeah. Let's do that. I mean, we're so used to that format going back to Lucy. It's a worthy effort to tear it apart.
Well, talk about the topic, tackling that in general.
What interested me about this was someone who'd spent their entire life in the black market and advocating for something that was illegal, and now they've gotten their wish. It's be careful what you wish for in mm-hmm. a way, because in a way, you could have told the story about bootleggers. And then prohibition is repealed and they open a bar, a legal establishment to sell liquor. And that comes with a host of problems that you don't have as criminals. That was my entry point to the series was, well, what happens if you've been fighting your entire adult life to make something legitimate? You succeed. And then in that success is a world of problems.
Yeah, what'd you make of the animation? Where'd that idea
animation,
come from to do that?
It came from David, and there was a lot of pushback at first about doing it because of the expense and whatnot.
Was that Netflix pushback?
Warner Brothers, the expense of making the show. Yeah. Yeah, my big role in that was say, get out of his way. Let's clear some space because this is an insanely creative and funny man. Let's create some space for him to do something that hasn't been done before.
You even have Easter eggs on the set, mm-hmm. You know, if you look closely and you could probably pause it, which I think also seems to be a nod to how people now watch mm-hmm. TV. Have you gotten used to the idea now that people watch TV differently, that they don't necessarily want to wait a week, that they're just going to consume all of these episodes at once and then move on? Are you okay with that? Is that just part of the way?
I actually like both ways of going at it. I love waiting for next week's Game of Thrones. I really do. Yeah, I'm frustrated when the credits roll and it's over and I have to wait a week. But the expectation of seeing the next episode is fun. It's part of the way I grew up with television. But at the same time, I spent a weekend watching Ozark on Netflix. You know, I just went berserk and watched 8 episodes in a row or something like that. It was terrific. And it's like sitting down and reading a book. You don't wait for the next chapter. You just read the next chapter. And they're both legitimate ways of telling a story. It's just... I don't know that one's better than the other.
Well, you're a guy who's obviously been in this industry for a while, and you've seen how it changed. From a creator's perspective, you know, where do you see creatives going in the coming years? We just saw Shonda Rhimes, for example, do a mm-hmm. big deal with Netflix, and she's going to explore that world now. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, you've got folks like FX's boss, John Landgraf, who's sort of sounding the warning bells that this might be a monopoly and that might not be a good idea.
I don't understand that. Yeah, I mean, it's like walking into the supermarket and going, there's too much food here. I mean, complaining that there's too much food in the supermarket. It's fantastic. I mean, on one level, for myself as a viewer, there's so much to watch that to commit to a series, it's really got to be something. It's got to be special. And it has to be consistent. You know, if you're going to put it in front of the audience 10 episodes at a time, you can't drop the ball. And that's a magic trick to be able to pull that off. So I think it's fantastic. I'm loving it. I am totally crazed on television these days myself. Yeah.
And we should say real quick that you actually have another project in the works at Netflix, at the Kaminsky Method. So clearly your relationship is going pretty well over there.
I'm loving it. I'm loving it. It's an incredible opportunity.
Coming up after a short break, Chuck Lorre tells us why he thought the story of a young Sheldon Cooper should not be told in front of a live studio audience. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Michael Schneider, filling in for Kim Masters. We're talking to Chuck Lorre, creator of many TV shows, including the wildly successful CBS sitcom The Big Bang Theory. Actor Jim Parsons has won multiple Emmy Awards for his portrayal of Sheldon Cooper, a super smart, socially awkward physicist. Recent seasons have focused on Sheldon's evolving relationship with his girlfriend Amy, a neuroscientist played by Mayim Bialik.
I've never seen results like this before.
No, we need to stop for magnets on the way home. This is going right on the fridge.
Aren't you glad you participated in this?
Oh, I am. And you realize what the next step is.
Set up a second culture and try to replicate our results.
No. We lock that door, lower our underpants a little, and make a baby.
When The Big Bang Theory starts its 11th season this fall, there'll be another Chuck Lorre show premiering on CBS as well. This one is called Young Sheldon, and that's Sheldon as in Sheldon Cooper. The show tells the story of science prodigy Sheldon as a 9-year-old growing up in East Texas, surrounded by a family that tries to support him but doesn't quite know how to handle his intellect. Ian Armitage plays young Sheldon, and fittingly, Jim Parsons provides the voiceover for his inner dialogue. Zoe Perry plays Sheldon's mother, and Montana Jordan plays his older brother, Georgie, whose major concerns in life are less scientific than Sheldon's.
How come we ain't got no tater tot?
I made tater tots last night.
I'd take tater tots over mashed potatoes any day.
Just eat what I made you.
Can we at least have tater tots tomorrow?
It was family dinners like this that led me to adopt a mid-Atlantic accent. Nobel Prize winners ought not be ordering tater tots.
Everybody excited to start school Monday?
I am.
I guess so.
Georgie, freshman year, that's a big deal.
How can I be excited when he's going to be in the same grade as me?
Don't worry, Georgie, I'm not planning on being in the 9th grade for very long.
Though the show shares an obvious connection to The Big Bang Theory, Lorre would really prefer Young Sheldon not be called a spinoff.
Well, we tried to think of it as a prequel. We're not taking any characters out of The Big Bang Theory to start another series. This happens in 1989. Sheldon is 9 years old and growing up in a household in East Texas. And it's about how he's grappling with being this extraordinary mind in an ordinary environment and how the people around him have to deal with him. I mean, the whole family has to adjust to him. The school he's in, the pilot is his first day in high school at the age of 9. And I didn't want to lean on The Big Bang Theory. I didn't want the audience to think we were, you know, stealing or borrowing or trying to drag The Big Bang Theory over to another show.
Yeah.
So single camera allowed us to create an entirely different feel and a different look, a different tone, different pace. It's much more intimate, more filmic, obviously. You know, there's no audience, laughter. It's just a little movie. And I also was trying to be conscious of the fact that we'd be working with young children on this series and putting a live show up in front of an audience every week with adults is really hard. I didn't want to do it with young children. That's just asking too much.
What was the biggest challenge for you in adjusting to the world of single camera?
It's so slow.
Yeah.
It takes so long. A dinner scene where the family's sitting around a table having dinner, that's what, maybe 4 pages long. It takes as long as it takes us to shoot an entire episode of The Big Bang Theory in front of an audience. It takes 4 hours, 5 hours. It's unbelievably, torturously slow. And I'm having to find ways between when the camera moves from one place to another. You know, you start thinking about alternate lifestyles for yourself and maybe I should pick up a hobby.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
It's really a different pace. The 4-camera thing is a breakneck race through the week with rehearsals, rewrites. And then you're in front of an audience at 6:30 and you're done at 10. The show's shot and the editing takes a couple of days. The editing on the single camera show, I'm brand new to it. I'm still learning about this. It takes a long time. There's a lot more going on.
And the writing is different too, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not the same kind of beats. It's just a different kind of...
I don't want to say the tyranny of the live audience. I just did though, didn't I? But yeah, the goal in writing is different. When I'm working in front of a live audience on a show, I feel a commitment to generate laughter. You know, I mean, if you're in a rock band and you're playing in front of an audience, you kind of want to see people get off their seats and move around a little bit. You want to see that you're having an impact. And I think for comedy, the only impact you can connect with is laughter. Yeah. You got to hear that. If you don't hear it, what are you doing? But, you know, and when you're shooting it as a film, you're saying, I believe this is funny. I hope you agree. You have no litmus test. There's no audience around you to tell you if you're right or wrong. It's just, you know, we'll find out.
And it's less of a guffaw. It's a different kind of laughter too, right? When you watch a single camera show.
I hope there's some guffaws. I really do. I mean, there are comedies that I watch, the single camera comedies, where I laugh out loud and miss the next line of dialogue because I'm laughing. I hope that's still part of this. Snickering is not something to, you know, reach for. I don't want to. Oh boy, that show was clever. I want people to laugh.
Not big on the clever, but there's a sincerity to young Sheldon. Actually,
yeah, and scenes have the freedom to be warmer and have their own pace. You know, pace isn't dictated by the audience.
One of the last times I talked to you, you mentioned that you were looking to maybe do films, maybe you're ready to explore different avenues in your career, but it does seem like you're still really committed to TV and through these new forms, maybe a little more re-energized to do different things, do more shows for Netflix. Talk a little bit about where you see now where you're going career-wise.
Well, Netflix has opened up a lot of doors for me. I mean, it's made it possible to do things that I couldn't have done otherwise. And again, this is so early on. I'm slowly learning about filmmaking. I am really at the beginning of a large learning curve that others have been working on their whole lives. I've spent 30 years working in front of an audience, so I got a lot of catching up to do. But with Young Sheldon, I'm following Jon Favreau around during the pilot shoot, just asking questions. Why are you doing that? What's that lens? Why'd you change lenses? What's the camera doing now? Why'd you do that? I mean, he was really patient with me. He was really wonderful. And I got to watch a guy make a movie, which I've never had a chance to do before.
So Chuck Lorre is still learning. Real quick, one final question, because we're in your office surrounded by your past shows like Grace Under Fire, Dharma and Greg. We're living in a reboot culture now, Chuck Lorre. Mm-hmm. Do you ever think about reboots? They're rebooting Roseanne, that show right over there. What do you make of this reboot culture we live in? And do you see yourself maybe reinventing one of your shows at some point?
Not really. No, I'm pretty excited about where I am going forward with new stuff. I'd check it out if somebody wanted to remake Dharma and Greg.
Yeah.
You know, but no, I like being able to make stuff up and see if somebody will let me do it.
Chuck Lorre, creator and showrunner of many, many TV shows. His newest ones are Disjointed on Netflix and Young Sheldon on CBS.
Your voice is so sonorous when you did that. It was very FM radio.
Thanks so much, Chuck.
Thank you, Michael.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Kat Yore. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Michael Schneider. Kim Masters will be back next week. We'll see you then on The Business.